Hi, everybody. My name is Joan Fitzgerald, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very happy to be here. I'm very happy to meet you. I haven't been to this meeting, and you all know the protocol, so, and I don't, so I hope you just let me do what I do. It's one of my grandchildren says, Grandma, just let him do what he does. So, I guess I'll start by telling you who I am and kind of how I got here. I was born in Michigan. You probably hear that, and I apologize for that. But I don't hear it. My kids say that they can hear the Midwestern twang. So I'm quite lucky that I don't hear it. My name is Ryan, before it was Fitzgerald, and if any of you are Irish, you know what that kind of means. We had a lot of alcoholism in the family. My father was an alcoholic, very active alcoholic, and he left my mother and my brother and myself when I was little, very little. And my mom had to go to work, and in those days, women did not go to work after the war. They worked during the war, of course, in Detroit, as you know. Or maybe you don't. They made munitions for World War II. But that was before my time, okay? So at any rate, my mother had to go to work to support us because my dad did not. And I knew from a very young age that he was, he drank a lot. I don't think we ever said the word alcoholic. I don't ever remember hearing that. But I do know that that my mom had to work very, very hard. So, as I say, there was my brother and myself, and I began to wonder. I went to Catholic schools, parochial schools. Went to parochial schools for 16 years. So, I always, which includes college, but I always knew there was a higher power. I always knew there was a God. And I wondered why he let these things happen to us. I wonder why we were so sad. Particularly me, I was very little, and I was very sad. It was a difficult time. And then when I was in high school, my brother was in law school, our mother died. And again, I wondered, why did he do that to us? You know, why did he take our dad away from us? And why did he take our mom away from us? So at any rate, I was 16 and a senior in high school, and I went away to school for a year because I had an aunt and uncle living in South Bend, and I guess you know that Notre Dame's in South Bend. And across the street from Notre Dame is St. Mary's, where I went to school, but spent most of my time at Notre Dame. So at the end of the year, there were no girls over there either then. So at the end of the year, the sisters at St. Mary's and Notre Dame determined it would be best if I didn't return. And I didn't. And I went back to my home in Detroit, which I shared with my brother, who was in his last year of law school and was going to go into the Navy because he was due to be drafted. And at any rate, so it was a good time. I decided that I would get married, and I did. And I married a very nice young man from a wonderful family. and we proceeded to have four children spread out over a goodly number of years. But I had determined that never would alcohol ever impede on our family and my children and our relationship. And so, you know, I'm not here to say it didn't happen. I'm here to say that it did happen. But I come from a political family. My brother is a judge, and in Michigan, the judges run for office. So we had been used to campaigns, from the time I was young. We were both young. I was 19, and but we worked in campaigns. And lo and behold, the fellow that my husband worked for ran for Congress, and he won. And that's how I got here, is because this my husband worked on the Hill. And at that time, we had three little children. And I guess I mention this because I was so unhappy. I was so, so unhappy. And I was drinking like a lady. I drank, I called it the cocktail hour. And the cocktail hour was pretty much around the dinner hour. My husband was not home much, and I had three little children. And I remember one time feeding the baby with my martini sitting on the dining room table. And I'm feeding the baby, and I'm thinking, you know, this probably isn't right. This probably isn't right. It's 5 o'clock at night, and I have these little children. I fed them. They're all safe. And but I'm drinking, and it probably wasn't my first martini. So, but and that's what they talk about in the Big Book, is the first time you get that idea that maybe there's a problem. And but I didn't do anything about that problem for many, many years, many, many years. I'm not going to talk about a drunk log because I frankly think women's drunk logs are pretty boring. So I can be boring without telling you, you know, that whole story. Because actually it was. I drank at home primarily, and I lied to myself and to everybody else because I did call it the cocktail hour. And I would drink out of nice glasses. You know, no plastic glasses, nice glasses. As I sat at my kitchen table, and as the years went on, I would look at the circle on the table that my glass was making, and then I would decide just how miserable I was. It had nothing to do with alcohol. It had everything to do with the rest of the world. But and the more unhappy I got, the more I drank. And I, you know, I've been so fortunate. I've been so fortunate. I had, the three kids were in parochial schools. And I had carpools for my carpools. We lived in Fairfax. And, you know, we had football and we had Girl Scouts and we had soccer and we had whatever was going on. And I had always had to be, my children would get up in the morning and say, are you picking up or taking? You know, not good morning, just are you picking up or taking? So I had to work my schedules around my cocktail hour. And I would start in the morning thinking, okay, if I'm taking the kids, or whoever it was, which one it was, then I could start to drink at the cocktail hour. I could start earlier because I didn't have to go and get them and bring them home. And that thought started the first thing in the morning. And it lived in my head. Alcohol lived in my head for years. I either thought about drinking or not drinking. And how much or cutting back. Or there's nothing in the house. How am I going to get it? And what's he going to say when he comes home? And if I would get a six-pack of beer and bring it home, I would drink the three beers and think, he's going to notice. So I drank the other three. The insanity of the disease. So that fateful day happened in April in 1983, and you don't have to do the math, it's 29 years ago, I was sitting on the sofa in the living room, and my daughter, at this time we had four children, And my daughter, who was 18, maybe, was upstairs in her brother's bedroom. Her brother was away at school and talking to her father. And she was crying. And I heard her. It was why I wasn't drunk and in a blackout is known to God. Because I was in a blackout. I was a blackout drinker. I was in a blackout every night. And this night I wasn't. And I heard her crying. And I went upstairs. And I went into the room. And I heard her say, I can't stand it anymore. And her dad answered that. And she said, well, what about Carrie? And Carrie was the little one who was 9 at that time. And he answered that. And he walked out of the room. And I went in and I sat down with her. Actually, I sat on the floor. I don't know why I sat on the floor. She was sitting on her brother's bed. And I sat on the floor and I said, I will die for you. I would die for you. And she said, I can't stand it, Mom. I can't stand your drinking. And I don't remember what the whole conversation was. But I said, I will do something about it. And she went to bed. And I came back downstairs and I cried all night long because I had nobody, none of my children had mentioned my drinking to me and ever. And I found out a few years ago they didn't talk to each other about it either, which I thought was interesting. So the next day I didn't sleep and I didn't drink. And the next day, which was April 27th, 1983. I got out the Yellow Pages, and I found AA, and I called and got intergroup. And the fellow, I was sure now, here was the deal. I figured I had to find this AA situation, and I had to go to a meeting or something, but it wouldn't be right away. I'd have some time. I'd have a little bit of time. So the fella who answered the phone, I wish I knew who it was. I may know who it was, but I didn't know his name. He spoke with me for a while, and then he said, you need to go to a meeting. And I said, well, I figured that. And I was sure, I lived in Fairfax, and I was sure he would say, you know, a week from Tuesday in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. And he had the audacity not to say that. It was a Wednesday, and he said, 1 o'clock at St. Mark's this afternoon in Springfield. I had no excuses. The jig was up. I had to do something. So I went to my first meeting, and it was a women's meeting, but there were some men there. There were, I think most of the men that were there did different, you know, worked the second shift. They did shift work, and I think that's why they were at the 1 o'clock meeting. But the first person who came to greet me was a gentleman whose name was Ollie, and Ollie was in his last stage of cancer, and he said to me, "You are the most important person in this room," and of course I'm sobbing. But that was not an unusual thing because I sobbed most of the first year anyway. And he had this round circle, which you may have seen. It really is, I think, pressed cardboard. And on the front of it, it says T-U-I-T. And he said, I know that you thought you'd stop drinking when you got around to it. Here's your to it. And I still have it. I still have it in my drawer with my chips. So that first meeting was, I have no idea what these people said, except that I remember them saying what a beautiful day it was and how beautiful the azaleas were and how they were so grateful to be alive and they heard the birds chirping. And I thought, these women are lunatics. I don't want to meet them. I don't want to know them. I have nothing in common with them. Don't they get it? You know, don't they understand that I have found myself in the depths of my life, which is being in an AA meeting? It wasn't that I was an alcoholic. It was that I had to find myself in an AA meeting. Here I am, supermom. Anything but. So that began my journey to happiness. I had a difficult time. It was very difficult. God was so good, has always been good to me. But he took my compulsion to drink very early, I think. I think it was in the first maybe 30 days, maybe 60 days. I remember thinking on a certain day, you know, I haven't thought about drinking at all today. That's really weird. But, yeah, I haven't planned it. Because when I did drink every day, when I took my shower, I planned on not having cocktail hour. Every day, I planned. Well, today I won't. And every day I did. And some days it got earlier and earlier in the day. But, so I began to, I didn't hear a lot of what people were saying. I really was in a terrible state of despair. And the reason was, I was in AA. The insanity of this disease had just taken over. I didn't blame my disease of alcoholism, even though I heard you all talk about it. I blamed myself because I was not a good mom. Good moms aren't in AA. Well, you know what? I know some of the best moms in the world who are in AA, and the best dads who are in AA. But I worried that I would not survive. I just thought, I am not. What's going to happen to me? And also, my marriage was falling apart. I learned in these rooms that AA had nothing to do with that, that my marriage had been falling apart for a long time. But I was just terrified. I was terrified as to what was going to happen. But what I did do that year, and I went to meetings, and I went to, our meetings are at 8:30 at night, mostly. Not so much now, but then they were. And I remember going to these meetings in strange places that I'd never been before, because God forbid anybody would see me. You know how that is. No, I don't want anybody to see me. After all, they know me as Mike's mom or Tim's mom or Molly's mom or Carrie's mom, because that's the only identity I had. But, you know, that's ridiculous. It's part of my insanity. So, and I remember it raining. And I would go to these meetings at night, and it was dark and it was raining. And I thought, you know, something's going to happen to me in this parking lot. And I'm going to be in the Washington Post that's going to say, Fairfax woman killed in parking lot on her way to AA meeting. And this is the insanity. This is the insanity. Now, you know that I came in April. You know it didn't rain every day that year. You know it wasn't dark every day of that year. But it was dark for me because I was so depressed. It took me a while to listen. I came to the meetings. I thought I was listening. Maybe I was hearing and not listening. But it took me, I think it took me quite a while. And I knew I was powerless over alcohol. That was no big deal. Is that all you guys got? You know, I know that. But then they would say my life was unmanageable. They don't know me. See, I have everything under control. I've got these carpools under control. I've got these children that are okay. They're getting along just well. So what's out of control? That took a long time. That took a long time for me to understand. that my whole life was out of control. And one of my largest problems was I thought I should control it. You know, I thought I should control this husband that doesn't like me anymore, or for a long time. I should control the teachers and the economy and the government and who was running for the presidency. I need to control these things. So this is the insanity of my disease. That took a long time. That took quite a long time. But then, of course, there's the came to believe. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. But first, I had to believe that I was insane. So that wasn't easy for me either. How dare you say that? I'm a very smart person here, you know. I mean, after all, how dare you say I'm insane? But I finally, and I would go to meetings a lot, but I'd also was find myself sitting in the back of churches on Sundays, and there's nobody there but me just crying. And why am I in a church? I'm mad at God. I'm really mad at God. Why am I sitting in this church? Well, that's part of the insanity, was sitting in a church and crying, saying, I have no control over what's going on in my life. If this marriage doesn't survive, I have, because I didn't work outside the home at that time, I don't think. But, you know, how is this going to work out? How am I going to take control of what's happening here? I need to get a job. I need to support the kids. I need to do all these things. How am I going to do this? And I can't do it. I just can't do it. I'm always going to be miserable. I'm always going to be unhappy. But I didn't drink. That's the one thing I didn't do, was I didn't drink. And I didn't want to. I think it's part of the stubbornness. You know, I think my stubbornness is a gift. It was a gift at that time, at any rate. But that's when I knew that I had to turn my life over to this higher power that I chose to call God. I knew that, because I think I'm kind of a logical thinker when I'm not in the throes of alcoholism, but I knew that I was completely powerless. That came to me somewhere along the line, that I really had no power, and that was okay. That really was okay. It was a relief, you know. It was like the weight of the world had been lifted from me. I didn't have to control my life, the kids' lives, my former husband's life. I didn't have to do that because my higher power was going to do it if I would let him. And that's when it began to fall into place, that I not only didn't have this weight anymore, but I could be happy. And what an enormous enlightenment that was for me, that I really could be happy. I could be happy. And I didn't get all happy, you know. I found that some of the days I did, then I had this job, and the first job I had, I worked in Alexandria, and I would be driving to work, and I would think, you know what? It's okay. This must be what they're talking about. This must be serenity. I'm not mad at the traffic. I'm not worried. I'm not worried about what's the next thing that's going to happen. Because I did turn my life over to a power greater than me. I did turn my life over to a higher power. And so that's when the joy, and they're just little bits of joy, would come into my life. And it began to make some sense. This program began to make some sense to me. And then I began to be grateful. And these women that I thought were all flowery and bird singers, you know, they would talk about their God. And that's when it started to make sense to me, that I have my God, not the God of Northern Virginia, which I don't live in anymore, or I live in Locust Grove, not our God, but my God, who, if I let him, will show me how to live a happy life. And that's what's happened. I don't mean to say that there haven't been issues and problems, and yes, there have. You can't live 29 years and not have, you know, problems. But I know what to do, I think, now. I know how to do it now. I have gratitude that I never wanted to hear about. When you come to meetings and people say, let's have a gratitude meeting, everybody goes, oh, you know, what do you know? You don't know. What are you grateful for? You don't get it. You don't know what's going on in my life. And that's how I thought. These people have no idea how tough my life is when they talk about how grateful they are to be recovering alcoholics. And I have to admit it, I'm one of those women. I am grateful. And what I've learned is that this program, for me, the beginning part is how to not drink, and the rest of it is how to live. I, the knower of all things, did not know how to live. I had no idea how to live a life. I let the life live me. I thought I knew all there was to know, and found that I knew nothing. But my higher power does. And he got me in this room because I didn't walk in one day and say, this is the place I want to be. He got me in here for a reason. And the reason was he wanted me happy and sober and to live a happy life. So I have lived a happy life. Like I say, it hasn't been all joyous and free, but it's been a life. What I have are the four kids. I have six grandchildren who never saw me drink, who from the days that, you know, there's a lot of joy in my life, and some of it is you wouldn't get, and maybe some of you do. But one day, some years ago, Erin, my little granddaughter, called and said, Grandma? Yes, Erin. I went potty today. And you just turned around a couple of times, and then the phone rang and said, Grandma, it's Erin. Hi, sweetheart. I got in to the school I wanted to get into. So it's from her excitement of going potty to getting into Christopher Newport. I'm very excited for her. Very excited for her. But I'm mostly excited for the gift that she called her grandmother. You know, what a gift that is. So I have these grandchildren who I think like me. I have reason to think that they do. And I sure am crazy about them. And I have 29 years. Now, I never could have lived. I don't think I could have lived 29 months, because my disease was so advanced that I drank every single day and I had blackouts every single day. So there's no way I could have lived 29 years. And I hope that the good Lord has a few more years, because I've got more grandchildren than I want to hear where they're getting into school and a few other things, but it's up to him. So the gift of sobriety is just that. It is such a gift. I can't reason it. I can't explain it. But I know, and why I got the gift, I have no idea. I have why me? my very best friend, who we went to high school together. Our parents went to school together. We married boys who went to school together. She had four, I had four children, and we thought alike, and she lived in Pennsylvania, I lived here, and she died with this disease. And I remember standing at her casket saying, "Marianne, why? You know, why? Why you? Why not me?" And that's a question, but there's no answer. There's no answer for that. I think that someday when I get there, I have a list of things to ask my higher power. That's on it. One of the big ones is, what were you thinking when you invented the adolescent brain? Yeah. I love it, the fact I have six adolescent grandchildren, and payback is hell, isn't it? But I have many questions, and many of the answers I already know, is that this is a spiritual program. I don't think we can get away from accepting that. It is a spiritual program. It is a gift. I don't know why we all have it. I don't know why we had to go the path we had to go to get it. And I have no idea what's ahead of us. But I do know that I'm a happy alcoholic woman, and my children have not escaped this disease. So that's not a given. You know, I have one child who is who's an alcoholic, active alcoholic, and it's painful. It's very, very painful. He had some run-in with the law. I'll tell you this, that this is the insanity of this disease. He had spent 10 days in jail. I cried every day of those 10 days. When and if it happens again, I won't cry. But that time I did. And he didn't want me to know. And when he got out and he realized that I knew, I said, "Mike, if you go to meetings, you're going to see guys you know." I said, "I see guys you know, but I can't tell you who I see. I see kids you went to high school with, you know." And he said, "I don't want to see anybody I know." He said, I did what I had to do. I went to ASAP, and I went to two AA meetings. Now, he lives in Virginia, in Northern Virginia. And I said, "That's great, Mike." And I said, "Where'd you go?" He said, "I went to two meetings in Maryland." This is the insanity of this disease. And I said, "Why is that?" And he said, "I wasn't going to walk in those rooms and have everybody know I'm Joan Fitzgerald's son." What? Come on. I realize that's the insanity of our disease. You walk into the rooms, nobody knows who your mother is. But, I got to tell you, besides that, we don't look alike. He looks like his dad. But at any rate, that's his reasoning. So what do I do with that pain? I do what I do with everything else. I pray, and I turn it over. And for me, I kind of have a saying that I third step in, is what I do. I can only, I cry about it, I feel awful about it, but nobody could get me into these rooms. Nobody could talk me in these rooms. And he has a higher power. And I know that, I feel that his higher power will show him the way as my higher power showed me the way. And it may come through the same way. It may come through his children. It may come through the little girl that said, "Grandma, I got into Christopher Newport." It may happen that way. But I know that I don't have the control and I don't have the power other than to be, I think I make him nervous, tell you the truth. I think I make him nervous because I don't drink and, I don't buy alcohol either. I don't even know how to buy alcohol. I was looking at, somehow or another, I got caught in the aisle in the supermarket, and I thought, they really have pretty bottles now. I'm not even sure what's in the bottles, but they really are nice-looking bottles. But I don't have it in my house, and my kids never even think about it when we're all in my house, at any rate. I think I'm going to turn things around a little bit for a minute, if you don't mind. And I'm going to ask you folks if you have any questions of me. Don't be scared. I'm not scary. Do you have any questions? Is there any new sobriety under a year? Yay! Yay! That's good. I'm happy you're here. And don't be afraid. Because we want you sober. No questions? Yeah.
Liz Reagan, alcoholic. So how do you live one day at a time today? How have you integrated a...
I think that living one day at a time is probably one of the most difficult parts of the program for me. And I think a lot of it has to do with I have so many children. I have, some of you don't think that's a lot, but I have 4 kids, and I have 4 in-laws' children and 2 ex-in-law children who are still part of my family and the 6 grandchildren. So there's always drama going on in this, always going on in this family. It's, the economy's bad, and it's hurting some more than others, and health-wise, and the one who is still out there active. So there's always something going on. And I have to really force myself to pray every day, please God, show me what I can do. And if the answer is you can't do anything about this, then I have to accept that. But it's an everyday thing for me, that I have to live in the day. And, obviously, the clock's not going backwards. And I'm getting older. And I want to live every day. I want to live it to the fullest. Because I was given this gift. And I feel a responsibility. I feel that I've been given the gift of sobriety, the gift of this program. And I have a responsibility to nurture it and to live a happy life. As best I can. Did that help at all? Sam.
Do you have a men's story you'd like to share with us, if you're willing to share with us?
A men's story? I don't have any men. No, the only men's, you mean for?
A men.
Oh, amends, making amends. Oh, yes, I do. You scared me. And no, you can't record this one. Yes, I do. I think an amends story. I will tell you this: is that I told you my father was an active alcoholic and abandoned us. I use that word. He left us. And my feelings for him had gone from I hated him. I hated him. And he was a very, very handsome man, very good-looking man. And he moved away. He moved to Dallas with a woman. And she had 2 children about the same age as my brother and myself. And I found these things out little by little by little. And I saw him, I did tell you, my brother's a judge. And at some of those ceremonies, a couple of them, he and his wife came to Michigan for the swearing-in ceremony. And I didn't want to see him, and I most definitely didn't want to see her. And I was young, pretty young at the time. I wasn't in the program. And so I didn't. He wanted to see me, and I didn't want to see him. And then, so I think maybe the third time I did. And he wanted to see my children. And I had three at the time. And so I said, okay, you can come and see the kids. And he said, sis, I don't think my mother ever told him what my name was, because he always called me sis. So he said, would you give me some pictures of the kids? I said, yes. And I just wanted him out of there. Sure, you're going to have pictures of the kids. And, but I had a visceral hate for that man. I really did. And when he was dying, my brother called me and said, I'm going to go and see Dad in Dallas. And he said, I'm not going to tell you what to do. My whole life, my brother has said, I'm not going to tell you what to do. However, so I said, okay, I would go too. And we went to see our dad, and he was dying of this disease and others. And he asked for pictures of my children. And I had absolutely no intention of giving him pictures of my children. And I told him, yes, sure, I will. And I never got to make an amends to him when he was alive. But it was through this program that I realized that my hate for him was keeping me back. And it was keeping me from having a good relationship with my higher power. And I was able to do that after he died. And I pray for him every Sunday. I pray for him today at church. And I pray that it was my disease. And what is so interesting is that the man that I hated because of his disease, I have the same disease. And I couldn't get that. I couldn't get that until I'd been in the program for a while. But I did. I pray for him definitely every Sunday, sometimes other times when I'm, you know, saying my prayers. But that, and my amends to my kids, they're just so happy. They're just so happy that I'm sober. And I have told them, you know, how sorry I am. It makes them a little embarrassed. They don't like it when I talk about that. They don't like talking. The little one doesn't remember. She doesn't remember, but the other three do. And then I'll just tell you one other thing. The house that we lived in when I went up, Molly was the daughter who was up talking to her dad. We had sold it, and we had been out of it for 20 years, I guess, 22 years. And the girl next door called me, and she said, Mrs. Fitz, we're having a party for these neighbors down the street that we had all moved in at the same time, and the neighbors were moving away. And I said, oh, great, Patty. And she said, would you come? And I said, where is it? She said, it's in your house. And she said, I really would love it if you'd come. She said, if you were there, it would make my mom closer to us. Her mom and dad had both passed away, who lived next door. So I said, okay. So I think the party started at 6 o'clock, and I was intent on getting there at 7. So I pulled up, and we lived in a cul-de-sac in my house, in front of my house. I had never met these people because I didn't go to the closing with them. I went by myself, so I never met them. So I pulled up in front, and it started to rain. And I just sat there and prayed and said, please, God, help me do this the right way, and please don't let me cry. And I got to the front door, and the fellow who owned the house and his wife, they could not have been more welcoming. They couldn't have been nicer. And then I saw some old neighbors that I hadn't seen in 20-some years, some 30 years, and that was great fun. And I, three women, sat on that sofa, and we were looking at pictures, where I had sat that year, back in 83, and heard my daughter talking upstairs. And I sat there in the living room on that sofa, and I realized that you go out of the living room through the foyer and then turn this way and then go up the stairs, and it's a turned staircase, and go up the stairs and then turn into a room. And there's no possible way you can hear anybody talk when you're sitting on that sofa. There's no way. And I didn't get that until a couple of years ago, that I knew that my higher power had created all of this scenario, but then I saw that there's no way that you could hear the sound. So that's where God is in my life. Anybody else? Okay. I think I'm done. Thanks for letting me share.